Hey, Dad.
What do you want, Logan?
What do you call moccasins that your mother gives you?
A gift?
Freudian slippers.
Oh my God, I want a freaking refund on you. Go away.
You're listening to The Wayward Willis with John and Logan, where two atheists discuss religion, culture, and maybe some politics. If you're offended by blasphemy, profanity, or you hate fun, podcast may not be right for you. And now, on to the show.
Hey, you.
It's us.
At least for the next hour or so.
Right. I'm your host, John.
And I'm Logan. But don't tell anyone or I'll gut you.
This week, we're talking about idolatry.
So, what even is idolatry?
Well, the dictionary defines idolatry as worship of idols.
Well, that was a depressingly short definition, and it even managed to use the root word.
I freaking know! I hate it! Hashtag make definitions great again.
That's not a hashtag.
It can also mean extreme admiration, love, or reverence for something or someone.
Someone?
Yes, Logan. Someone.
Emma Watson!
Have you gotten that out of your system now?
Fuck no! This is the Emma Watson episode now, bitch!
Just kill me now. So, what even is Emma Watson?
Well...
No! Shut your goddamn mouth! Moving on.
Rude as fuck.
True. In order to discuss a word that includes another word, you have to define two words, obviously. Otherwise, you're just doubly ignorant and your family will sell you to a band of roving slavers so they can get a Nintendo Switch and not have to share it with you.
This is starting to sound oddly personal.
I don't know. That being said, an idol is a cult image, usually in the form of a statue or totem. In the book of Exodus, Yahweh says exactly what he thinks an idol is. He says, quote, "Any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth." It's super broad and basically bans all art except for music, when you think about it.
Though it might ban early 2000s Windows Media Player visualizations, and I think we all know that the world would be lost without those.
Well, the world is definitely a sad, cold place now that Winamp is gone. But I think his silence on music is why God has never struck anyone with lightning at an American Idol audition.
Yep. As much as he might hate their voices, they're not technically doing anything sinful.
Unlike this podcast.
Boom, fucking meta, bro!
Also, and this is a sidetrack, the part where he says, the water under the earth, is really odd. It flashes back to the notion of a flat earth with a dome cover sitting on top of a mass of water that can flood the entire world on command. I mean, the word under carries a pretty specific meaning. Why is it that gods can never use precise language?
Well, technically, there's tons of water beneath the surface of the earth. And the entire ocean can be considered to be below the Earth's surface. I'm gonna have to give the J-Man the win here.
Fine. But was there also a big contingent of spelunkers and cave divers back in Moses' day who were constantly drawing blind fish? The Bible's stupid.
Disqualified from the intellectual debate.
Oh, shit. So, another sidetrack, but completely related, is that the Arabic word for idolatry is shirk. It basically means to practice polytheism, which is obviously haram. Maybe even double haram.
You can't triple haram a double haram!
Unfortunately, it's unrelated to the English word shirk, which means to practice fraud or trickery, and stems from an older German word meaning scoundrel. Is this a coincidence?
Oh boy, where's the X-Files music when you need it?
I mean, practicing idolatry could be considered fraud, and would therefore make you a scoundrel. Boom! Tied up in a pretty little boat!
Alright, you can take your tinfoil hat off now, buddy.
Okay. Last sidetrack, I promise.
There's always another sidetrack.
Yeah. Islam has the concept of greater and lesser shirk, classified by Muhammad himself. Greater shirk is open and blatant polytheism or attribution of Allah's qualities to something that isn't Allah. For example, if you were to say that some other god, like, I don't know, Odin, is Allah's brother and they basically do the same things, this would be greater shirk. I think if you say Odin is better than Allah, it's something like Mega Shirk.
Like Mega Shirk versus Giant Squid? I saw that movie.
No.
Oh, okay, good, because I didn't actually see that movie. It's just a meme, bro.
Oh, nice one. In addition, if you ascribe human traits to Allah, it's also Greater Shirk. This includes painting Allah as a human, which is also blasphemy, which in some cases also gets your magazine office shot up by fanatics.
Hashtag too soon.
Hashtag je suis Charlie.
No.
Fine. Lesser Shirk is a little more subtle and open to interpretation. It's basically the same as when a Christian might call another Christian a Pharisee for being too showy or self-righteous. If you pray or perform rituals in a way that makes you seem overly pious, then the idea is that you're elevating yourself and practicing polytheism.
I'm so good at worshiping my God that I'm basically also God. That logic checks out.
Yo, dog, I heard you like worshiping God. So, yeah, I guess the idol in this case is yourself. I've met you. You're not that great. Get over yourself.
Wow, rude again.
Anyway, it's pretty much a given that a god who wants to be worshipped would outlaw the worship of idols. Kind of like how a guy could conceivably get jealous of his significant other's relationship with their vibrator. I mean, it's great that you have something you can use in a pinch, but I'm right here, darling. Can you maybe put it away for like 112 seconds?
Dude, if that's an accurate measurement of time, then I'm going to guess no. And also prepare to be single soon and for the rest of your life.
Oh. Remember what we said last episode about words hurting? I'm fragile.
Apparently so is your vast deference. Boo! Anatomically roasted as fuck.
Speaking of fragile, it's laughable that nearly every personal god concept ever devised by humans has had a problem with jealousy. If you have a mountain full of gods who are all competing to be the very best, like no one ever was, but you had a bunch of indecisive humans who were trying to catch them all, then I could see having some rivalry and perhaps some jealousy.
10 out of 10 casual Pokemon reference. Nicely done.
Thank you. Thank you. But if you're the god and you've gone out of your way to let everyone know that there are no other real actual gods, how could you possibly be jealous of idols? Especially when every idol from every season hasn't been much more than a flash in the pan. Except for Kelly Clarkson, I guess.
But she couldn't possibly deserve worship like Emma Watson does.
Go to your fucking room.
Only if Emma Watson is there. Wait, is she? Has this whole thing been an elaborate scheme to hook me up with Emma Watson?
No.
Worst dad ever.
All of this really points to the fact that humans created gods and not the other way around. And idols are the perfect example of how this works. I mean, legends like Paul Bunyan work every bit as well. But if you leave some people alone for a while, chances are they're going to melt their Apple Watches down and fashion them into a little fat guy statue to whom they can burn incense and telepathically ask for things.
Sounds plausible.
Yeah, at least I think that's how it works. My Apple Watch is still on my wrist, reminding me of a podcast release schedule I nearly always miss. I'm a baddie.
True as fuck.
Go screw yourself.
Done.
Different gods have different punishments for idolatry. Sometimes no punishment at all, just the scorn of your peers.
Actually, sometimes this is the worst sort of punishment.
Like the disappointment of your father?
For sure.
In ancient times, when gods were totes more involved, people might actually have been killed on the spot. But since the internet came around, there's just way too much to keep track of, and gods are busy.
Dude, what if that's why we haven't seen God yet? Maybe he's just so sucked into Facebook memes that he hasn't even gotten out of bed and put on real clothes yet, much less made a trip down to see us.
Interesting theory, but that just means he doesn't have a good work ethic.
Wow.
Anyway, I guess he can't afford to micromanage every sin. Although, since gods are supposed to exist outside of time and space, they could pull a Hermione and smite the idolaters one at a time and just keep winding the time turner back.
Oh, okay. So it's cool when Hermione does it, but when Doctor Strange does it, you think it's ridiculous?
Well, if they would have cast Emma Watson as Doctor Strange, perhaps I'd been a little more charitable.
Wow.
Does that sound like it would work, or does the time turner only apply to homework anyway?
I don't know, but as long as Emma Watson is involved, you won't get any complaints from me.
Oh, true, true, true. We keep talking about one of the most prominent features of religion, which is the I'm right, you're wrong mentality.
This is also the mentality of the dad character in the movie Matilda.
Oh, I don't know if Roald Dahl is a genius or if that movie just had phenomenal writers, but they knocked it out of the park.
Dude, I freaking loved that movie when I was a kid. Oh no, is this what showing your age is like?
Yeah. At this point, all I have is age.
Oh, shit, self-roasted.
This mentality comes up pretty naturally when you're talking about Islam, obviously, because it would be difficult not to be an idolater with the kind of framework they've set up. But it's also something I was indoctrinated with throughout my childhood as a Protestant in reference to Catholicism.
I can't handle all these sub-religions. Too many labels. We're all just nerds. Let's leave it at that.
Oh, okay. Well, Catholics
nerds
have the idea of saints and, as a practice, venerate the Virgin Mary because she was the only hottie God would fuck. Catholic statuary is a huge deal in their cathedrals, and it drives Protestants nuts. But that's probably because Protestants have stooped to megachurch warehouses that have no class. Jealous much?
Jealousy is sort of my signature move.
Wow. I was always told that Catholics aren't real Christians because of several things. First, they worship Mary and pepper everything with statues, medallions, and paintings of her. This is idolatry because even though she was Yahweh's fuck buddy, she isn't Jesus Christ. Even though technically Jesus Christ would have been half Mary, so then Protestants are like diet idolaters?
Not to be confused with people who idolize diets. Those people are the worst.
Oh, dude, did I tell you I was doing paleo? Blech.
True.
So, second, their Jesus is still on the cross, while the Protestant Jesus is alive. Leaving Christ on the cross means you don't accept salvation from his death and resurrection, which is super duper important. So, the Jesus Catholics worship is a false idol, somehow.
One of these Jesuses is not like the other.
Oh yeah, that's how it works. So, third, they pray to saints, who also are not Jesus. Also, what's with all the saint bullshit? Protestants don't need intermediaries to work with Yahweh. They're like best buds and shit.
Well, they're just part of different friend groups, you know? Sometimes it's weird to call up your friend's friend to hang out. You gotta coordinate it together.
Oh, okay. But it does help when somebody sends you a friend request and you're like, oh, okay, they're friends with what's-his-face.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or it's okay. Like when you're trying to hit on a girl, but like you don't want to be too forward. So you're like, hey, man, do you think maybe you could like hang out with us and like we could go on a little like friend hangout together so that I could like get my in? And then your friend's like a good wingman and he's like, yeah, sure, cool. I'll set it up. It's going to happen, bro.
Oh, so saints are just wingmen.
Yeah, basically.
Nice. Okay. It's all coming together now.
Yeah, there you go.
Idolatry is just another way to demonize other religious groups and maintain an air of superiority, even while they're breaking their own rules.
Demonizing religious groups and maintaining an air of superiority while breaking your own rules? This sounds exactly like being an American politician. Hit me up with that X-Files music again.
You're all about conspiracies today, aren't you?
Nailed it.
All Christians lean heavily on the symbology of the cross in their buildings, decorations, clothing, and art, and the last time I looked, a cross is an image of something in the earth beneath. That's a graven image, folks. Congrats on your hypocrisy.
You know what else is a graven image? Literally any picture of a graveyard. Boom! Dad joked.
I like that one. That was good.
Yeah. Yeah.
But don't even get me started on the Ten Commandments monuments they want to plant all over the country. Those aren't just wrong because they're graven images. They're wrong because they're fucking wrong. Get that shit off of my courthouse lawn.
Wow. You just cranked your old man mode up to 11.
Oh, I should have been like, get off my lawn. I think part of the reason idolatry is even a thing is because religions needed a hook for converting people of other cultures and religions. Other people had their religions with their altars and statues in the souvenir shops, but visitors had too many choices, so it took forever for them to make up their minds and even longer to move them through the checkout lines, you know, because they like didn't have barcode scanners and Apple Pay back then. So monotheistic religions were like, dude, we can streamline your process and boost your profit by clearing all of this out and selling nothing but crosses. Then the people were so grateful for the Christians' help with their souvenir shops, they signed a billion-year contract to furnish all their hotel rooms with Bibles. And that is the story of how Osiris died from capitalism. The end.
Wow. I feel so much smarter for having heard all that.
You're welcome. This book will change your life. Hello. This book will change your life. Hello. This book will change your life. This book will change your life. But maybe not. Hello and welcome to the second part of my book review. I am reviewing Inside the Atheist Mind by Anthony DeStefano. And last week I did the intro and chapters 1-3. Today I'm going to be doing chapters 4-6. One of the things that I wanted to say about the review last week is that even though I tried to be as thorough on each of the points he was making as I could, I kind of abbreviated quite a bit of it. And the reason for this is because, as I was saying, this compilation of Christian apologetics is not something that most people haven't heard before. The, you know, like when I went through the list of scientists and artists and creators that also held a religious belief of some sort, I really didn't feel the need to name all of them, like Einstein and Newton and Michelangelo and all of those, because you've really heard of them before. And one of the things that I'm going to do going forward is, if there's something that's especially poignant, or it seems like it's an argument or a quote that hasn't quite made the mainstream, then I'd like to point that out and just kind of give it a fair critique. But for the most part, if there's some tired old apologetic that he trots out, I'm not really going to spend too much time on that. So that's going to be my modus operandi going forward. So what I'd like to do now is get into chapter 4. Chapter 4 is called The Intolerance of the Atheists. Now, we already mentioned in a previous chapter the whole Merry Christmas thing and the war on Christmas, Fox News, thank you very much. And there is no war on Christmas. There is a push for inclusivity. And Christmas is perfectly fine. Like, there's a secular basis for the tradition to begin with. And a lot of people, atheists and Christians and anybody, can incorporate those traditions and the secular portions, the gift giving, etc., into their holiday and family traditions. So that's really not a problem. The problem comes in with people feeling excluded. So, you know, Jews and Jehovah's Witnesses and, to my knowledge, Muslims don't celebrate Christmas the way that Christians would define it. And so if you're in the public sphere and a person wishes you happy holidays, then that's a generic and inclusive enough term for pretty much anybody, even Christians, if we can please just admit to being reasonable, even Christians can find that message non-confrontational and inclusive rather than exclusive. But Anthony is one of these Christians that believes that if you aren't explicitly respecting his views, then you are being intolerant. You are trying to push him out of the public sphere. You are trying to demean and force his religion, his specific religion, not to exist. And that's really not the case. But this chapter is all about how atheists, militant atheists, want religion to go away. And I'm not going to argue with him. He actually has a point there, because a lot of the outspoken atheists and anti-theists, which maybe he should have used that word specifically, but anti-theists don't want religion in public. And what he does is he quotes specifically an author named Zoltan Istvan. And this author wrote in the Huffington Post and basically said that he wants regulation to restrict religious indoctrination of children until they reach about 16 years old. And after that, you can just throw religion at them all you want, because at that point, they probably will have learned some critical thinking skills and have had some life experience to deal with supernatural beliefs and claims. So basically, the gist of this is that forcing religion, indoctrinating children, is tantamount to child abuse. And I struggle with this because it seems a little extreme, but having lived it myself, I don't disagree. All of the doctrine of specific sects of religion, especially the ones that are a little more cult-like, or the ones that are way more patriarchal and authoritarian, like Islam. But, you know, even in my Southern Baptist home, the first line of defense when it came to child behavior was hitting a child, was spanking. It wasn't, you know, a side look. It wasn't a request to stop. It wasn't a gentle redirection. It was, you're going to get hit. And that's not a rational way to treat a child. You're only going to teach that child that violence is the answer to solving problems. And there have been multiple studies to back this up. So my experience tells me that even though this stance seems pretty extreme, it's not completely untrue. Now, do I want government to regulate and restrict religion in the sphere of parenting and society as a whole? I don't really think so. I think that that gets way too far into like dictatorial modes of government. And that's not really what I want. Because here's the thing, and I think that this is the thing that a lot of political groups and especially religious groups don't understand, is the government changes over time. And if you implement these authoritarian, very restrictive forms of government that are in your favor, there may come a time where that government is no longer in your favor and they are still going to have that power. Now, once that government changes hands and they still have that power, you're going to see that you are going to be on the receiving end of what you initially dealt out. And so that's the kind of mindset that I try to take when approaching these topics. And, you know, in much the same way that I wouldn't want somebody to say anyone who doesn't believe in a God has to behave this way or has to do this or must be restricted to X, Y, or Z, I don't want to say that people who do subscribe to God beliefs have to do this or have to do that, because I just think that that's the wrong way for a society to be governed. So that's my stance on it. But Anthony obviously trots out, you know, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Jerry Coyne, people like that who have made public statements about how religion just needs to go away. And I agree with these statements. I may not go to exactly the extent that some people do, but what I would like is for religion to be a private thing. And here is another quote from Giovanni Santostasi. I've never heard of this person. But what they say is, religion should remain a private endeavor for adults. An appropriate analogy of religion is that it's kind of like porn, which means it's not something one would expose a child to. And Anthony gets indignant at this. So religion is like porn. Oh my gosh, you have to do it in private. Well, here's the point that I would make. And honestly, there's not a whole lot more substance to this chapter than just the war on Christmas and we don't let you force everyone to pray. The point that I would make is, Jesus said this. Jesus told his disciples, when you pray, go into your closet alone with your God. Don't make a show. Practice your religion in private and just commune with your God all you want. You can do it all day long, just like watching porn if you want to. That's not something that you make a show of. It's not something that you force on other people. It's just between you and your God. And I don't understand why Christians as a whole, but specifically Anthony, is getting upset about this analogy, because this analogy is biblically accurate. When you pray, pray in private. That's not how Christians operate in this country. That's not how Muslims operate. That's not how most religious groups that you know about operate in public. They want to make a show of it. They want to make a public display of it. And that's, for Christians specifically, that's contrary to the fundamentals of their religion. If Christ is the basis of their religion, then his own words mirror this sentiment. So the war on Christmas, or the war on religion, or the intolerance of religion that Anthony is talking about, is merely the atheist and the other religious groups' desire to not have Christianity specifically pushed on them against their will. And in that same vein, children should have that same consideration. So I feel like Anthony is completely wrong here. he would never see it. And most of the, you know, evangelical Fox News, American flag shirt wearing Christians are not going to see that as well, because they have been given this great amount of privilege throughout the history of this country. And now that that's being reined in a little bit, or that at least, at the very least, that we're asking them to rein that in a little bit, they feel like they're being oppressed. And this is just the ongoing theme for Christian books in general, this book, the Christian movies that we see, and they just propagate this belief throughout the culture. So that essentially sums up this entire chapter's point. Atheists are asking, and in some cases telling, religious people not to be religious in public, and that is just completely intolerant. Well, you know, philosophers like Karl Marx have taken the same types of stances. Well, you know what? I haven't read Karl Marx. I don't subscribe to that philosophy. I make my own philosophy as an atheist. And he's going to do this throughout this book, is to bring up philosophers and writers and, you know, thinkers that not a whole lot of the ordinary average people have read. And we form our worldview based on our experiences, based on our interactions with other people, and our view on the supernatural and the utility of religion. And if those things happen to line up with philosophers and other thought leaders, then that's fine. I mean, just because I might like to paint doesn't mean that I am aligned with Hitler. And those are the kinds of false dichotomies or false comparisons that are being made. So most of the time when he mentions someone like Karl Marx, I'm going to have to admit that I just have not read those people, and I don't really have any kind of commentary on it. But what I can do is comment on my views from an atheist standpoint on the points that he's making, irrespective of the actual words of those authors. So that's how I'm going to be approaching this. And we can move on to the next chapter. Chapter 5 is subtitled The Shallowness of the Atheists. And when he's talking about shallowness, he's not talking about interpersonal relationships or views on the opposite sex or anything like that. What he's talking about is intellectual shallowness. Now, what he says is that the two other traits that are most important about atheists, arrogance and ignorance, are certainly very big defining traits of atheists, but the one that deserves the most discussion is intellectual shallowness. And it's kind of funny, just from an analytical standpoint of this book, he says that this one deserves the most discussion, but this is actually one of the more average to shorter chapters in the book. So there wasn't actually more discussion on this topic. It was basically the same amount of discussion. And when it comes right down to the discussion of the shallowness of the atheists in this respect, the only thing he's really talking about is the straw man fallacy. And the straw man fallacy is when you take what somebody has said or what somebody believes or what somebody has written, and you make assumptions in your own mind about what that means, and then you present that as the true meaning of the words of the other person, and then you attack that. That means that you have completely made assumptions about what the person says or believes, and you are presenting that as their true beliefs or their true words, and attacking that to make it seem ridiculous. So apparently atheists are only capable of making straw men out of Christianity and attacking those straw men because they are easy prey, kind of like low-hanging fruit. So the examples that he will give are like the story of Jonah, where we're like, oh, you can't live inside of a fish, or the fact that we sometimes call it a whale instead of a fish because that's not what the book says. It's not a whale. It may seem more likely that a person could be inside of a whale for a short period of time and survive rather than a fish, but who knows? this is one of the things that he brings up. And to me, it's really not that important, especially since there are a lot of Christians who will say, well, this was a story with a moral. It was kind of like an allegorical look at the consequences of disobeying God or turning your back on your responsibilities or your faith. And that's perfectly fine. I mean, I feel like a more honest person with a more honest look of the Bible would admit that pretty much most of it is allegorical, especially since a lot of the historicity doesn't line up. But the fact is, and I've made this point before, is that when you go to a church and you talk to people in the pews, certainly from the front of the church to the back of the church, you're going to get people with different beliefs, different level of belief, different commitment to the beliefs, and different interpretations of what those beliefs actually mean. But you can go into one single pew and talk to people who are sitting basically side by side, and you will still get division in major beliefs about specific doctrines or even vague concepts about the Bible, what it means, who God is, what God is, how God works, how prayer works, etc. So all of those things tend to lead a person looking in from the outside to think that there's a problem with the doctrine and the beliefs as a whole. If I talk to one person and they believe that the Jonah story is absolutely 100% true, the fish swallowed him, he lived inside for 3 days, it spat him up on the shore, and then he was a changed man, well, that's what I'm going to address. If you tell me that you believe something literally, then I have to take you at your word, and then I have to address those points as being literal. So other people will say, Jonah, the story is allegorical, it just represents a crisis of faith and a corrective action on the part of God in general, and that's the lesson that you're supposed to take away from that. And that's perfectly fine, because then you can talk about it that way. But if you talk to one Christian and get their take on it, and then you talk to another Christian and you use that first Christian's take on it to actually move the discussion, then that second person is going to be offended that you're creating a straw man and not representing their beliefs accurately. Now, the problem is, a lot of times when you talk to somebody about their beliefs, even Anthony, you're not going to actually get an accurate picture of what they believe, and you could succumb to shifting of the goalposts, because they can tell you that they believe something, and then if you repeat back to them what you understand that to mean, then they can say, no, that's not what I said. These are my beliefs. You can't just nail these down, and what you're saying is not actually what I believe. So you misunderstood me. And that kind of thing can just lead to a frustrating, never-ending conversation with somebody who hasn't really reasoned out their beliefs enough. And I find that that's the case with a lot of people. So it's frustrating sometimes to critique religion or to discuss religion or to just discuss belief in general, even when it comes down to something as vague as spirituality. I feel like it's kind of hard not to prop up a straw man by accident. Sometimes it's certainly easy to prop up a straw man on purpose. And those are the kinds of things that Anthony is griping about here. Now, one of the things that I will say that kind of irritates me about atheists who are critiquing the Bible and religious beliefs is the bats are birds argument. And I do understand the context of what they're saying, that, you know, the Bible can't be scientifically accurate because it portrays bats as birds, and they're obviously not birds. But if you look at the religious interpretation of scripture, then you can certainly see where, you know, people who didn't have a scientific understanding of classification back then would see a bat flying. And having only ever seen birds fly and saying things that fly are birds, then they could say that bats are birds. And to me, that's not really a sticking point. I mean, if you want to talk about scientific accuracy or the prescience of scripture, where, you know, obviously it was accurate because it was telling us things that we didn't even know at the time. Well, even at the time, we could have said bats aren't birds. They look like mice. But that, I don't think that that's a really good point to be made. And I feel like that is one of those straw man arguments that Anthony is attacking here. So I do have to give him credit just from this standpoint that you can't know what a person believes about something unless they tell you. And if you're critiquing their beliefs from the outside, then chances are you are going to prop up a straw man, even if it's by accident. Hopefully it wouldn't be on purpose. But it's funny to me that the intellectual shallowness chapter in this book is itself shallow and really only talks about straw men as the fallacy that we all know it to be. Because I don't think that that's the only thing that atheists do, especially, you know, vitriolic, militant atheists that he's talking about. I don't think that's the only thing that they do that you can critique as being a little bit shallow and or lazy. Because a lot of times we don't really want to spend the time to actually study scripture, because why would we? That's, we don't believe it. But that often produces a more shallow view of what the scripture says, what the beliefs are, and what the religion formed around it actually means. So he does have a point here, but I don't think he makes it very well. And I feel like he could have done a lot better. Or he could have just omitted this chapter altogether and it would have been perfectly fine. So that's really all the substance to this chapter, and we will move on to the next. Chapter 6 is titled The Cowardice of the Atheists. And what he is basically talking about in this chapter is the fact that atheists don't really have the courage to stand by their convictions under certain circumstances. So he goes back into the bully analogy, and, you know, we've always heard that when it comes right down to it, bullies on the inside are just insecure, cowardly little people who need a hug or something like that. And so he goes into this sort of reasoning where we are afraid of the consequences of what the opposite of our atheism would mean. And we're afraid to accept the true meaning of what being an atheist means, and that we're too afraid to just go all the way. And instead of taking atheism at its core and saying, this just means that I don't believe you when you say there's a God, what we should be doing is going full bore and saying, not only do I not believe you that there is a God, but I know for a fact that there is no God, and I stand by the courage of my convictions. Well, the problem with that is even the most hardcore atheists on the, you know, the atheism scale from 1 to 10, you know, if I say that I'm a 7, well, that's a pretty strong atheist. That means that I have never heard anybody produce any kind of reasoning or any kind of argument that would convince me that there is a God. And furthermore, that I have at least a suspicion that all of these arguments toward God are false because it just seems so unlikely as to be impossible. That does not, however, mean I know for a fact that there is no God, and there would never possibly be any kind of argumentation or evidence that could ever convince me because it just doesn't exist. But then one of the bigger points that he makes on the cowardice of the atheist is with regard to Islam. And, you know, Christians definitely have this problem in the United States because they're the majority religion, where they are often the target of criticism and critique and even judicial activism or actions like that. And so, you know, rightly so, atheists in the United States spend most of their energy talking about Christianity because that's what we're surrounded with. Now, events like 9/11 and things like that will obviously make us take a look at things that we are less familiar with, like Islam, and provide critiques to those. But because we're not as familiar with them, it's harder for us to really come up with good critiques and criticisms of that religion until we start studying it. So Christians definitely have a persecution complex in this country just because they are the majority religion. And atheists in this country tend to attack Christianity more so than Islam. But what the point that Anthony makes here is that we know that Islam is a violent religion, and in some cases, critiquing it can get you killed. And the fact that atheists, the big name militant, you know, atheists who rail on Christianity so much, will not attack Islam for the most part because they're too scared, because they might get killed. They're scared of violence. And you know what? There's a little bit of truth to that, I suppose, but I honestly don't have a problem personally calling out Islam on its horrible behavior and its ridiculous beliefs when I get the chance or when I see something that comes into my field of view. And, you know, it is true that my willingness to critique that might be different depending on my setting. And if I did live in a majority Muslim country like Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan, then I might be a little more reserved on my opinions on religion publicly because I would know the consequences. So I suppose there is a point to be made there. But the thing to remember is that an atheist's stand on the question of whether or not there is a God transcends the boundaries of specific religious ideology. So if a Muslim says that there's a God, our answer to that is no, I don't believe that that's true. If a Christian says that there is a God, we say no, I don't believe that that is true. If Hindus say that there are gods, we would say, no, I don't believe that that is true. And that is consistent. It's a consistent view. And I think that potentially what Anthony can address here is the behavior of atheists who are speaking out against religion in different cultures and about different religions, the behavior and the attitudes that they take and their willingness to be a little more vitriolic toward one religion than the other. And he says that, you know, Christianity has not put people to death for criticizing it, and Christianity has, you know, shown to be a peaceful religion, you know, much like the Islam is a religion of peace argument that is made on the other side. But there have been instances, certainly historically, where Christianity has perpetuated great violence over critiques or competition of religion. And so that's not entirely true. It's just that in this secular country of the United States, with our secular laws and our hopeful inclusivity in our culture, Christians can't just get away with, you know, chopping people's heads off and chopping people's hands off and implementing their specific brand of justice, because they can't. They won't get away with it. So, yeah, you know, the United States is kind of a safe space for atheists. I get that. And I don't deny that. And I don't deny, you know, benefiting from that as an atheist. But that doesn't mean that I'm a coward. It doesn't mean that the atheist position is cowardly. It just means that we have to prioritize what's going on in our country before we start branching out and being able to change other cultures. So if I'm surrounded by a bunch of muggers in an alley, then I'm not going to be concerned with somebody across the street who just dropped their can of tomatoes. Like, I'm not going to feel like my priority is rushing across the street, you know, pushing through these muggers and rushing across the street to pick up a can of tomatoes. It's going to be self-preservation at that point. And that's not cowardly. That's just how things work. So I would have to deal with the muggers first. Like, that would be my primary concern. And then I would have to let my bubble expand, my bubble of concern expand, and address the other things that are going on in my world at that point. So, you know, sometimes it's perfectly easy and it's perfectly acceptable to multitask and you have the bandwidth and the ability to do that. But then other times you have to address the more pressing immediate concerns before you can concern yourself with other things. So he makes a segue into his next chapter, which is going to be really rough. But he says that, you know, if atheists actually felt like their worldview was consistent and a materialistic view of the world is what would contribute to happiness, then, you know, people who are multimillionaires ought to be happy. But we overwhelmingly see that people who are the most famous and the richest are the most unhappy. And, you know, yeah, in some cases, that's true, whatever. It doesn't matter. But the point he's trying to make is that atheists claim to be all about enjoying life, making life better, and being just all about life. But he says that atheists are really all about death. And he's going to prove that in the next chapter. So expect to have a chapter full of talk about abortion and euthanasia, because that's where he's going with this, and that's going to be really tough, and I'm going to have to kind of steel myself for that one. So that's what we're going to pick up with next time. That is a critique of chapters 4, 5, and 6 of Anthony DeStefano's book, Inside the Atheist Mind. And if you feel like I left anything out, if you feel like I was completely wrong on anything, then please reach out to me. Let me know. I would appreciate the criticism because this is my first attempt at going through a book for the podcast, and I may not be very good at it. So I will be back next week with at least another 3 chapters. I might just finish the book altogether, and we'll see how that goes. So thanks a lot for listening.
Random verb.
Random verb.
Random verb.
Random verb.
Our random verse this week comes from the book of Job, chapter 21, verse 24. It goes like this.
His breasts are full of milk, and his bones are moistened with marrow.
That's it?
Yeah, that's it. So, basically, hey, do you know what male lactation is called?
Male lactation?
It's called galactorrhea.
Oh boy.
That sounds
like a sci-fi word.
It kind of like Battleship Galactorrhea.
Oh, God.
Where everybody on the battleship just has milk leaking out of their nipples. Their uniforms include nursing pads.
Why? I feel like this should have been an internet meme by now.
Right? Oh, my gosh. Make this happen.
Make it happen.
Make Battlestar Galactorrhea happen.
Oh, geez. So the context of this verse is because it's in the book of Job, it's all about like how Job gets fucked up because of a stupid bet between God and the devil. And there's one point where everyone's like, dude, why don't you just like throw your middle fingers up to the sky and say, Hasadiga Ibawai, which you probably don't get.
No.
That was from the Book of Mormon. One of the songs is Hasadiga Ibawai, and it means fuck you, God.
Okay.
Which I love. I actually have been looking for a chance to use that.
Well, congratulations.
Yay me. So anyway, while all of these people are like, dude, your God is a fucking dick, why don't you just dispense with all of the pleasantries? And then he goes on this rant that is like 43 chapters long and is talking about how you don't know my God. He does this and he is this. And the non-believers are all like, meh. And my God is like, eh. And then blah, blah, blah. And that's basically the whole rant, except for part of it is talking about how his breasts are full of milk and his bones have marrow in them. Which,
wait, gods?
Yeah, gods.
Okay.
So, first of all, God is not human, so he doesn't have bones. But at the same time, it does say that we're created after his own image. So if we have marrow, I guess he does too.
Yeah.
But it's not as though this is a real revelation or that it has anything to do with anything, because everybody's bones have marrow, except... Birds.
Wait.
And maybe dinosaurs. I don't know.
Maybe he's talking about his dick.
So this just took on a really gross meaning to
me. Maybe his dick is filled with marrow.
Maybe he that means he has multiple dicks because it says his bones.
I mean, I was going for, like, every time he gets an erection. Although, I guess if you have marrow in your dick, it's probably erect all the time.
Yeah, I would think so. That would all be right. So, pain. God has multiple dicks.
And they're all always hard.
And moist. Ew. Wait, are they moist? No, they're moist with marrow, not moist with milk.
Wait, does that mean that they're moist on the outside? There's marrow on the outside of his dicks?
Wait, actually, that's weird. Why would they be moistened with marrow?
Is marrow known for its lubricating properties?
Well, Logan, in fact, the bone marrow is where white blood cells are generated.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, scientific fact.
That answers science. My question, totally.
Well, maybe he's talking about white blood cells. Dude, the Bible is scientific. Before we ever knew it, Job knew that bone marrow produces white blood cells.
I'm a Christian. How we got there, but fair enough.
Christian. I'm a Christian. I love God.
You heard it here first, folks. Jesus, John my Willis homie. Just converted to Christianity.
Hell yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so his first statement as a Christian was hell yeah.
Hell no. Help hell not for me.
Nah.
Hell not for me. Yeah, so this whole, like, his breasts are full of milk, I don't obviously think that this is supposed to be literal, but what he's trying to convey is that God is nurturing, so it's allegorical, metaphorical, poetic, and all of the above.
Well, you gotta pick one.
Oh, let me give you a little quiz here. Is this verse A, allegorical, M, metaphorical, or P, poetic?
I'm going to go with D, none of the above, and kindly go fuck yourself.
Aww. Okay, done.
That's my favorite test question answer. I
D,
give up.
Go fuck yourself.
Yeah, basically.
So, any other thoughts on this?
I don't know. I feel like I probably shouldn't be as aroused as this verse made me.
Or should you?
So, wait.
What?
Hold up a second.
Whoa.
If his breasts are full of milk, and that's supposed to be like a metaphor for him being nurturing, that would make him maternal.
Yes.
In a sense.
Yeah.
And that basically means that Job is letting out a Freudian slip here.
Because God is supposed to be the ultimate of manliness?
He immediately follows that statement up with a statement about his dicks.
All the dicks. So Job's got a little Oedipal complex here.
Yeah. Wait.
Dude.
Wasn't Job one of the people who actually did commit incest?
No. That was Lot.
Oh, my bad. Sorry.
Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't his mom. It was his daughters. It's whatever.
Fair enough. My
like,
bad.
It's totally fine. I'm sure they were like 17.
Well, okay. So. So anyway. So if you had to rate this verse on a scale of 3 breasts full of milk to 3 penises full of marrow, what would you give it?
I would give it a fully operational Battlestar Galactorea.
All right, you win this one.
On a mission to find Earth.
No. We're done.
Well, that was fun. If you want to greenlight the first season of Battlestar Galactorea, you know where our patron page is. In the meantime, we need to thank the wonderful people who are already trying to get us there. And that would be Sojo, Part-Time Patron Russell, Lisa McLean, Holly Vane, The Sarah Talk Podcast, The Dumb All Over Podcast, Brothel Knight, Taro Tikkanen, Corey Hill, Corey Johnston of The Brainstorm Podcast and The Hardcore Skeptic, and Gaytheist. You're all the very best, like no one ever was. Until next week, if you want to send us your American Idol audition tapes, you can send them to podcast@waywardwillis.com. Intro music was provided by Austin Cologne and used with permission. You can find more of Austin's music linked in the show notes. This podcast is a media production of Willisware LLC. All rights reserved.
This has been The Wayward Willis. If you liked what you just heard and you want more of John and Logan, you can follow us on Twitter @WaywardWillis, Facebook @facebook.com/TheWaywardWillis, or @WillisWeb.com. If you want to help the show and have a few extra dollars, you can donate per episode or per month on Patreon @patreon.com/wayward. We'll be back next week.